My name is Luis and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it will also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dostina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Joe will read the preamble.
Good evening, I'm Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the Serenity Prayer. God, may serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Curtis will read the steps.
Hello, my name is Curtis. I'm an alcoholic. Step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Susan will read the traditions.
Hi, everybody. I'm Susan. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. The traditions. The 12 traditions. One. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Lest money problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Eric T.
I'm Eric. I'm an alcoholic. It's an incredible honor to be up here. I was sitting there wondering if anybody's ever thrown up when they got up here at the podium, or if they've ever passed out, or, you know, what happens if you have a medical condition, because I felt like I was going to have a heart attack sitting there. And I guess that's a good thing, because when I feel empowered to do stuff, when I really feel powerful, like, it's usually because I'm, like, in a burst of anger, like I'm losing my temper, I'm blowing up, or, you know, I'm completely trashed, and I'm, like, doing something that's dangerous, or I'm doing something that everybody else around me is scared to do, but I'll do it just because I feel so inferior about who I am that I'll take this life-threatening chance, you know, whether that's, you know, stuff I used to do behind the wheel in a car, high-speed racing around with cars to jumping off of cliffs that other people were afraid to jump off of and diving off of things that were probably too tall for someone with my skill to dive off of. But I guess I wanted to start off by talking about my fantastic year, and I've had a few fantastic years, but the last couple of years have been unbelievable. I've been exposed to the Atlantic Group. I've made the Atlantic Group my home group. I've been to the most recently the picnic that they had in Central Park. I was asked to speak at the Bill Wilson retreat and talk about the traditions for an hour, if you can imagine. That was the toughest thing ever, you know, but I do live and breathe the traditions. I mean, like, I think it's the most phenomenal thing about our organization, and I think, you know, the Atlantic Group is a great representation of their traditions. And I just came back from ICKYPA, an international conference of young people in AA that was in, I've been to two of them, one in New Orleans, and I was in the last one, was in L.A., 4,000 young people just, you know, staying sober. It was just phenomenal. I've been a member of NYCPA, and I got to see, I haven't been a member of NYCPA for the last year, but I got to watch them, like, make a phenomenal presentation to have a conference here in New York City, and I just felt proud to be part of this program. And I, you know, a couple of years ago, I didn't really know New York City. I've been sober since July 13th of 98, and I spent most of my first year of sobriety in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, living in my mom's basement, and going to 3 meetings a day, walking even though I had a driver's license, working for $6.50 an hour even though I was offered a lot of money to go back to do what I was doing as a practice prior to rehab. And I used to come into New York City to go to clubs, and, you know, I used to get really intoxicated before I'd come into the city. I'd get even more intoxicated while I was in the city, and I saw, you know, stuff that was able to keep my drinking going for a little bit while longer. Like, it was just exciting enough here in the city to, like, be able to keep going. Like, wow, there's a hope for somebody who wants to drink 24/7 and be intoxicated all the time. It works here. And what didn't work so well is driving them 2 hours back into New Jersey, you know, with hallucinations and stuff like that, because I hadn't slept for, you know, a long time. And I was scared of New York City. And one of my sober experiences was to come into New York City and get to know the city. I had a job in the city, just a small job. I have a business out in New Jersey. And I was asked to come in for a small job, and I hit meetings on my way, which is a story of everything that I do. When I go on a vacation, I hit meetings at that vacation. When I go to a different town, I hit meetings at that town. It's the most awesome experience of my life is when I connect with other alcoholics at other meetings and I get to know people. So I met some of the most incredible people I've ever met in AA in New York City. You know, from the young people, I've never seen so many young people that were sober. Where I got sober, there was only a handful of young people. And I come here and I can go to a meeting where there's 100 of them. I go to a meeting out there, 60 people would be big. I mean, this is incredible. I've been asked to speak, you know, at many different meetings. I've been asked to speak at anniversary meetings. I've been asked to speak in prisons. Some of my, you know, cool adventures of AA is going into Rikers. I've done it for NYCPA for a year and a half. We go in and bring meetings into 14 to 19-year-olds. I recently got to go on public transportation and with Vince to do the Atlantic Group Rikers commitment, and got to drive out in a Mercedes with Frank, and that was kind of cool rather than the subway. But 5 minutes is up. I was suicidal, like, before I ever picked up a drink. And when I picked up a drink, it was the greatest feeling I'd ever felt in my life. I'd never felt that experience. And I made it look good for way too long. You know, my mind kept telling me about that first week on a cruise through the Caribbean, drinking vodka straight, like, that was what this is about, and you're going to recapture that. And every time I'd get close to it, you know, I'd think, well, next time I'm going to get it. And I made a fool out of myself, and I actually did try to commit suicide, because I tried a religious approach. I tried, you know, things like clinics and therapists and my parents, and, you know, I tried praying to God, and I never had a problem with God. I always believed there was a God, and I always believed that he loved me. You know, I think he loved me, but I thought I maybe put myself in a position where I was unable to receive his blessings, unable to receive serenity in my life. And when I came to AA, I learned, you know, that my life wasn't over by giving up a drink. My life was just starting. I mean, my life has been fantastic. I never experienced these things when I was drinking. No matter how much money I put into the process, no matter how many times I lowered the bar, you know, to do one more thing that I said I'd never do. And my life is full of judgments. I spent all my time saying I'd never be like that alcoholic. We parked today, I saw a homeless person, you know, went in their pants, and I saw them dripping all over the sidewalk, and I know that's supposed to be me. I know that's supposed to be me. I wouldn't be lucky enough to die. Like, that's what I'd end up doing. And left in my own devices, that's what would happen to me. So I've tried to, like, anytime AA has asked me to do something, I've done it. If that's, like, not date in the first year, I didn't date in the first year. If that was, like, go through all the steps, I went through all the steps. I've been through the steps a couple of different times. And at any given moment, you know, I go back and do a 10-step. I work on, you know, my current relationship. I'm blessed to have a relationship. I've destroyed many of those relationships. I'm blessed to have my mother here. I'm blessed to have, you know, all my friends and people that I'm close to here. I used to just be a terrible, angry person that blamed everybody else for what was going on with me. It was my parents' fault, for sure. It was my teacher's fault. It was the religion I came from, its fault. It was the law. It was everybody else's fault. And I realized, sort of coming in, that, like, you're going to take away this alcohol from me. You're going to take away the drugs from me. This isn't going to help me. I've done it. Like, I've done a couple of months without my favorite, you know, thing. I've done the withdrawals and the pain, and it didn't go away. You know, that's what I felt like. This problem is me. It's not alcohol. And I didn't know how to tell that to people, because that's a good excuse to be like, oh, it's, you know, it's because I'm on heroin. You know, my life's so messed up. You know, it's because I, you know, all these things. If these bills weren't hanging over my head, you know, I wouldn't have to drink. If you know, if, just all these things. And it was me. And the steps is the most awesome way that I've ever experienced to, like, have a better me, so that I'm so comfortable that the only time I think of taking a drink is like half hour before I have to stand up here and talk to all you guys. I'm like, man, a drink would be fantastic right now. Like, it'd take the edge off. But I muscle through that. God has shown me enough miracles and given me so many chances. You know, I just, when I don't feel it, when I don't feel like God loves me, when I don't feel like I'm doing like where I'm supposed to be, and I can't change that, I just hold on this time. I white knuckle, I hold on until it passes. And when it passes, it's so awesome. I've experienced things that I never thought I'd experience. I don't know if that happens just when you turn 39 years old and you're almost 40 and, you know, stuff starts happening. You're like, oh yeah, that's what they were talking about my whole life, but I feel like a real human being. I feel better than I've ever felt at any time in any of my drinking career, period, and anything else I've ever done. I've got 1 minute left. If you love alcohol like I do, you know, or did, and I don't anymore, and don't know what to do, and you're scared to go back out there without meds or go back out there without some other sort of thing to intoxicate you, like, I believe there's a spiritual path here that's laid at our feet. Find someone in the program that you respect. Find someone that has what you want. Ask them to help you. And I just, because I came up here for my second time up here, first time was my anniversary. I had a 9-year anniversary in July, and I forgot to mention my beautiful wife. I have a beautiful wife that this was her home group, and this is why I came here. And I'm so glad that I did. And I'm wearing the suit I wore at my wedding, and it's just a phenomenal place to be. So, thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Maya.
Hi, my name is Maya and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 12th of June 2007. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Elizabeth M. And I'm currently working on step 9. I came to these rooms 4 months ago. I was completely broken inside. I had this strong shell, always smiling outside, but inside I was completely, completely broken. In one of my first meetings that I came to, someone mentioned that soul is alcohol soluble, and that's how I felt. I felt that through the years that I drank, I had literally drank my soul away. And it's been amazing how amazing my life is now, what a huge difference such a short time as 4 months has done in my life. It's been that I've done a complete U-turn in my life, and I know that after, you know, many years of searching and trying to find a solution and trying to find a happiness and peace with myself, I know that I'm finally in the in the right track. I know I'm still in the beginning, but I know that this is the way to go forward. And I was born in Finland, youngest of three children. I've got a bit of an age gap with my sister and brother, and always felt a little bit separated from my family, an outsider in a way. I was spoiled, so it wasn't that. My sister and brother were very loving, as well as my parents. I had a very good childhood. I have no alcoholics in my families, and it was a good everything. I got almost everything I wanted. I got everything I needed, and there was a lot of love in my family. But I was also youngest of my both sides of my family and my cousins, so I had no friends to play with in a way. So I hanged out a lot with older people and with my aunties, and I guess that made me really want to grow up fast. I never wanted to be the age that I was. I was always dreaming of that. Oh, I'm going to be a few years older and my life would be completely better and all this. And I think that was the reason as well. I matured very early and I came independent. I didn't want to include my family in my life, neither in any of my friends. It was just I wanted to do things on my own way and wanted to do the responsibilities and take, you know, pay the consequences. When my family went to really conservative church, but we were the liberal family. within the church. So that was the thing as well, that I didn't quite fit in and I was always different. And I didn't like it. I didn't quite agree with what was preached and how people behaved. At that time, I started kind of like creating different friend groups because I didn't want my friends from school or from my hobbies to meet my friends with the church because I was so scared that one of my church friends would say something about going to church or something about Jesus or heaven or hell. I was very scared about that. And that continued throughout my life. So none of my friends really know about how much I drank or the quantity of my drinking because I had always different friend groups that I could be a little moody or I could be philosophical, you know, talking about life, politics, philosophy, all these. But, you know, the common theme with all these friends were that we were drinking loads. I had my first drink probably when I was 12 or 13. I liked the taste. That's never been my problem. I actually really like the taste of alcohol. But it didn't do anything for me. I didn't need, I've always been very extrovert, get along great with people, and made easily friends. So I didn't need it because most of my friends were drinking so that they'd have the courage to talk to other, you know, talk to boys or talk to girls and all this. And I never needed that. So I left it for quite a few good years. And in the beginning, my drinking was very, you know, when there was a reason to drink, when there was a party or celebration. I got married very young. It was both of our parents were saying that, well, maybe you shouldn't, maybe, you know, you're a little bit too young. And I've always been very stubborn. I said to my parents, like, I know exactly what I'm doing and I'm going to pay full consequences of this. We moved to England 7 years ago, and that was the time when I started drinking very alcoholically. I had several very severe illnesses, and the one that I couldn't handle was through those illnesses, I put on loads of weight. And because I've had very bad eating disorders, and it was just, I couldn't do it. I went to extreme, and that was my way of escaping the reality. I was drinking constantly, although drinking for me wasn't if I didn't get drunk. I could drink from the morning. I never drank when I went to work before going to work. Obviously, living in England, often did long pub lunches. Weekend started often with chilled white wine and brunch. But I didn't, as I said, I didn't consider that as drinking if I didn't get drunk, but I was constantly drinking. My life got really bad. I was behaving extremely badly, did absolutely everything that I shouldn't. I had this mental list in my head that I kind of like ticked through what I'm doing. All these things that the church told me that you shouldn't do, this is bad for you. And I went it through and kind of like ticked as I went along. And with the attitude, been there, done that, I didn't feel anything, so it can't be too bad for me. In the end, I felt exactly like a little puppet. There was a puppet master who pulled the strings, and I acted upon those. I was so miserable. I thought that the happiness wasn't for me, and I never contemplated on suicide, but I was often dreaming of dying. And this is the biggest, you know, one of the biggest things that AA has brought to me is the peace of mind and the willingness and, you know, to live the full life. It's been an amazing journey in AA. It hasn't always been the easiest thing, and I'm not always very willing to do the things, but I'm very blessed that I have an amazing sponsor who's been guiding me through the steps. And I've been working the steps quite fast, but I couldn't take the pain anymore that I was living in, or, you know, the misery, all this. So I knew that, you know, that could be my chance of getting a better life, and it has proven right. It's just, I can't even describe. It's just amazing. It's the peace that I have and the happiness and, you know, the biggest and the best relationship I've managed to create through AA is a relationship with my God. I found him back into my life, and it's, I can only thank AA for that. Yeah. I've been going to meetings, like, you know, they say for newcomers, go to the meetings, get the service commitments, get a sponsor, and I completely relate to all that. That is the best thing you can do at the moment. I've been blessed in a way that I'm not working in New York now at all. In the beginning, I thought that was the worst thing that could happen to me, being a workaholic as well. 6 months in New York not working is going to be the most horrible thing. But it has given me the time to really work on the program, get my life back together, and create new relationships and do amends to people that I've harmed, and also to learn to love for myself again. So the only thing I can say, you know, if you're new here, just don't go. That's what I was told. Don't go. Stay. It's the best journey you can make. So thank you.
And our main speaker tonight is Jack.
Thank you. I am an alcoholic, and my name is Jack. My home group is the West End High Noon Group in Long Beach, New York. And my sober date is September 20th, 1992. And they told me this is going to be a little scary. They lied. It's terrifying. I agree with Eric. Actually, I really shouldn't be afraid, because when I think of it logically, I would assume that just about everyone in this room is on my side, wants me to do well, and is kind of like rooting for me, the same way I root for everyone else in this room. And it's that way at every AA meeting I've ever been to, I've found. So it's a big room full of people, and people were always the thing that I feared most in life. I was always afraid of people. It was my biggest problem in life. I did a lot of crazy, scary things over the years that were life-threatening and didn't bother me at all, similar to what Eric was saying about crazy behavior, but people would scare the heck out of me. And here I am standing in this room over here in front of all of you, and I really know in my heart that you're on my side and I'm in probably the safest place I could be. But, of course, it wasn't always that way. I grew up in a crazy, dysfunctional, alcoholic household with 8 kids, an alcoholic father who also had a gambling problem, and a mother who was totally confused as to how she wound up in that situation and didn't know what to do about it, had no resources whatsoever because her husband drank or gambled away just about every dime he ever made. So she was kind of a survivor, and trying to survive herself. And all 8 kids kind of picked up that same life thought. This is about survival. So we weren't a big happy family in any sense of the word. We were 8 and probably 10 separate survivors trying to get through this with no direction and no support and a little bit of love, but you couldn't recognize it. I had one brother who was a year younger than me, or 15 months younger than me, and we kind of hung out together for years. We hung out together and we did things together, but we never talked, you know. And I never talked to any of my other sisters or my brothers because I was too busy surviving, and they were too busy surviving. So life was pretty scary. You know, I didn't know it at the time. You know, when you're growing up like that, you don't realize the predicaments you're in until later on. But looking back, I was scared all the time. I didn't know how to do anything. And I knew in my heart of hearts that there was no one in the wings ready to show me how to do anything. I had to kind of figure it out for myself. And I didn't do a very good job of it. And I got away with that for a number of years until I started moving away from the household. You know, as you get into your 11, 12, 13 years old, you start hanging out with kids outside the house, and you start seeing and observing how they live. And they seem to live pretty good. They seem to have happy households, and they had things, and they had parents at home who cared what time they got home and how they behaved and how they dressed, et cetera, et cetera. And I observed all of that, and it only fed into my insecurities and the feeling of being different, because I didn't feel any of those things, and it seemed everyone else did. And so when I got into 13, 14, 15 years old, this didn't get any better. It only got worse. I remember going to school and seeing lots of, in junior high school and high school, lots of other kids who all had normal, quote-unquote, normal households. And mine was not only not normal, mine was getting worse because there was alcoholism there. And, you know, alcoholism is progressive. So I remember going to high school with a lettuce sandwich with no mayonnaise on stale bread or something like that. And I'd sit down in the lunchroom, and these other kids would open up these lavish, thick Dagwood sandwiches with Twinkies and sodas, and it was horrendous. And it got so that I would skip lunch and try and hide out for the hour. And so, you know, that was the trend. And this was getting worse and worse, these feelings of being very, very different from everybody and being very, very less than, until I had that magical rendezvous with alcohol. And I had no idea what was going to happen, but it happened. I don't remember the particulars of it, but I remember getting drunk that night. I don't even know what I drank. And it was amazing. It was amazing because that sense of intense discomfort and fear was with me in my every waking moment, just in some sometimes greater than others, but it was always there. And it was like this giant anchor that I was carrying through life. I felt it even back then. And when I found the alcohol, the anchor fell away. Or as I heard one fellow say recently, the chains fell away. And I immediately gravitated to it, of course. I wasn't drinking regularly at the time, but every opportunity that presented itself, I jumped all over it and had my antenna up for these opportunities. The social network that I was part of back in that small town in Long Island at the time, our main function, these guys I hung out with, was stealing and accumulating cases of beer. I mean, we'd stockpile it. We'd have these locations where we could hide it. And it was might have been 15 or so guys in this group, and we would accumulate a lot of beers over there. And we would hang out in these places and drink these beers, and it was a great time. Everybody was having fun. And I remember back in those days, I got that uncomfortable feeling when it was time for them to go. Someone would say, "Hey, it's late, I got to get going," or and I'd look and look, and I didn't want them to go. And I'd be this, my brother and I would be the last two sitting there. And we realized often we'd be the last two sitting there, and it may be a sump or some other location, some other illustrious location where we were having these immense amount of beers. My brother and I'd be sitting there, and without talking, we realized we had to face the music. And the music wasn't we were going to be in trouble when we got home. The music was we had to go home. We had to go home to that house where we didn't want to go, that house full of strangers, you know, and who were all indifferent in some way or another. And so there was no sense of solace or a home base or anything like that. I was out there surviving. So more and more opportunities I would look for to drink. And by the time I was about to graduate high school, almost graduating high school, I already had a reputation as a heavy drinker. I went through 5 years of high school and still didn't graduate. I missed by a couple of credits and finally bailed out. But it was a joke at that point because alcohol was my number one focus at that time. I got a few knock-around jobs after high school, and of course, everywhere I went, I found the serious drinkers. It wasn't like I had to search for them. You know, we drinkers have a way of finding each other. And I found the heavy drinkers. Again, without planning it, without thinking about it, you know, where are the heavy drinkers? I just, there they were. And it was like not wanting to go home. But somewhere along the line, I run into this lovely, sweet, innocent Italian girl who knew nothing about alcoholism and nothing about alcoholics. And she was a great gal, very capable, very talented, very resourceful, and very ambitious. And she decided somewhere along the line that I would be a good husband. What kind of flawed thinking was going on there, I don't know. But that's the decision she made. And to make a long story short, a wedding was planned and we got married. I shouldn't really say, I should really add in one other thing over here that's probably, that might be indicative of what I'm more about. We thought at one point she was pregnant, so we ran off and got married civilly, only to find out a few weeks later on that she was not pregnant. But we went ahead and planned this big elaborate wedding 6 months down the road, and I had every opportunity to not go through with that because I sensed this was a mistake, that I was not doing her a favor, myself a favor, but I went through with it anyway. No thinking whatsoever. And we got married, and she embarked on this massive project to cure me of this alcoholic behavior, this heavy drinking, this periodic drinking, this crazy drinking. And she could, as I said, she was very talented, very resourceful, could do a lot of things. But she was no match for alcoholism, as we all know so well, try as she may. So all of her efforts, I mean, she would count drinks, badger me, watch me, warn me, threaten me, and to no avail. You know, it worked for a short period of time. But she, even she came to realize that after I had X amount of drinks in me, if I had 5 or 6 drinks back in those days, it was all over. She couldn't stop me, and she just had to hope for the best. And there were a lot of embarrassing, shame-based events that took place with the alcohol. I embarrassed her endlessly, and she still stuck it out. Her parents were lovely people. Her mother is still alive today. I see her occasionally, great woman. Even she said to her daughter, oh, stick it out, stick it out, stick it out. Things will turn around, because she didn't want her to get divorced, of course. And she tried. But it, you know, as we know, alcoholism is a progressive disease. She thought at least she could keep me in check at that time, but the progression was in place. It's like a freight train that's moving slowly and steadily down a hill. And it's never going to stop. It's never going to, it might pick up speed, it might slow down, but it'll always continue down that long, lonely path to end in some very, very unhappy place. Again, I didn't realize that at the time. We went on to have 3 kids, and pretty close in age. They're about 4.5 years apart, all 3 of them. And that was a struggle. I mean, I somewhere along the line, when I was 25 years old, I went in the police department here in the city. And the police department, I don't know if you New Yorkers probably know that policemen will have a cocktail with their dinner, given the opportunity. And we are not spared the disease of alcoholism and crazy drinking, and we're also not spared the problem of protecting the other drinkers, as is so common in other professions. Back in those days, if you were a drunk, they went to great measures to protect you from getting hurt, getting in trouble. And they would hide the drunks. And of course, as a rookie cop, I didn't get away with that part of it. I had to watch my P's and Q's. But as I accumulated time in the job and some tenure, I would be protected as well. And I would protect other people who showed up for work drunk. We'd hide them upstairs and do all kinds of things, thinking we were helping them. And of course, or they were helping me. And that was not the case, of course. I'm happy to say that has changed greatly today, but back then it was pretty bad. And so I would work these crazy hours. I'd work a week of 8 to 4s, a week of 4 to 12s, and a week of 12 to 8s for years. And each shift meant something different to my wife. If I worked the 8 to 4 shift, she had a shot at seeing me. If I had worked the 12 to 8 shift, she had a shot at seeing me after the shift. If I worked the 4 to 12 shift, there was no shot. It was like dawn. I'd get home just in time for her to go off to work. She had gotten a job, a big job over in out in Long Island, did very well at it, of course, became a manager, was very successful at it. In a way, she was running and hiding in her work while I was running and hiding in alcohol. I was running and hiding from the pain of life, and I guess in some way she may have been too, but I don't know. But as a result, these kids kind of were, ironically, in the same situation I was in. They were kind of like growing up, learning to survive with parents who had another agenda. My agenda was obvious. Their mother's agenda was not so obvious, but nevertheless, there might have been some unavailability going on there too. But I'm not here to criticize or judge her, believe me. But my middle son wound up really acting out. He was kind of the designated problem in the family amongst the kids, which is really not true, but that's what a lot of people believed back then, including me. And he certainly acted out. I mean, by the time he was 10 years old, we had been through a tremendous amount with him. He used to come up with ingenious ways to torture the neighbors. One neighbor he hated, so he went and took some fishing reels that I had and took the fishing line and wrapped it around this guy's house about 100 times, thinking he was going to trap the guy in his house forever, of course, and things like that. And then he would take piles of rocks and throw them. He had a great arm. He would throw them over the house, over trees, and land on a particular neighbor's house that he didn't like. And that's his way of acting out. Of course, he might have broken windows and doors. And he would do these crazy, violent things. Of course, everyone knew who was doing it. And they would come marching over to the house to tell me what this latest thing he's done. And then he got into stealing. And he was arrested when he was 11. And he had to go to court. And we've been to any number of counselors, up to school constantly. He was really acting out seriously. And it got so where I hated to come home because I would find when I turned the corner, my wife would be at work and there might be a babysitter there, or supposed to be a babysitter there, but I would find either a group of neighbors waiting for me or a police car waiting for me. So when I actually would turn the corner, I would dread the turn. What's the latest crisis that has occurred over here? And it wasn't so much about a crisis that he was in and the trouble he may have been in. It was a crisis like that I'm in. This is what my life has become. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew I stunk as a father and as a husband, but I didn't know it actively or consciously, but I was doing a horrendous job. And I knew that, and it was weighing on me tremendously. So that when I went, and I'd be at work and leave work and say, oh, my God, I got to go home. The same old feeling I grew up with. I got to go home to that unhappy household. And I said, well, let me just go stop and have a beer over here with the boys, and I don't have to go into the rest of that one. That could have been an hour late, and it could have been 3 days. No way of telling. It all depended. And it seemed that I would do that at the worst possible moments, when there was something event going on the following morning. One time we were going to Florida the following morning to go visit my wife's parents. And her boss from this corporation she worked in was going to drive us to the airport and take the car back. And I was working the dreaded 4 to 12 shift. And she implored me to please don't stop after work. And I gave her my word. And I was absolutely sincere. I knew the implications of my stopping. And I stopped. And it was an absolute disaster. I showed up a half hour before this guy showed up to pick us up at around 7 in the morning, completely reeking of alcohol, and I had to get in this crowded car with three kids, my wife, and this guy, and go to the airport. And my wife, if she could have gotten access to my gun at that point, she would have killed me on the spot. But I had long ago, long since gotten into the habit of taking bullets out of my gun before I came home. I mean that seriously, because I would come home in a drunken stupor, and she would punch the hell out of me in my sleep while I was sleeping, wasn't the word, while I was unconscious. And it was some kind of a release thing for her. I'd wake up with these aches and pains and bruises. And so, what the? And she wouldn't even tell me what she did. So with that in mind, eventually I figured out what was going on. And that's when I started taking bullets out of the gun, because she was a fiery Italian, and she could very well have lost it and you know, just say, the hell with this, and done me in one minute. So, and she probably went and searched for the gun and the bullets too, for all I know. I don't know, but anyway. So I would do things like that, like when she really needed me and was relying on me, I'd let her down. And in that instance, and in many, many, many others, at any kind of a social function, it got so she turned down, you know, this big Italian family, you know, if you don't show up at the social function, you get calls. Why not? You know, you're going to Uncle Tony's house for a barbecue, you will be there. You'll bring the drunk, but you will be there. So she had to bring me, and eventually she wouldn't go, you know, and there was a big scandal in the family. And when she doesn't show up, it's like, why isn't she showing up? Oh, something's radically wrong in that household. They all knew, and what was wrong was me. And she was mortified over it and crestfallen, and it felt like a complete failure as a mother and a wife and everything else. But I was in the throes of my alcoholism and couldn't even conceive of it. So anyway, my son, this guy that was the designated problem in the family, thrown out of every kind of school, and eventually was going to the local Catholic school, and we got tossed out of there. They called up one day and said we found him selling pills to the other kids in this little local Catholic school at 12 years old. And the mother superior there just called and said, here's what's going on, don't bring him back. I don't care where you go, don't bring him back here. And I said, well, where? She says, I don't care where you're going. She hung up the phone. And I had to go and shop around and get him into local school, into another program of some kind. Eventually, we wound up in a program through some counseling out in Long Island that was a family treatment program geared around kids, problem kids, like the son of mine. So we were able to get an interview for that program. One of the things they said in this interview was, here's the deal. We take over your life completely, everybody in the family. You have no say about anything. We'll tell you exactly what you're going to do socially. You'll tell us everything that goes on in your life. You'll tell us who comes to your house. No one uses alcohol in the household. No one comes to your house and uses alcohol. If you don't want to do this program, say goodbye right now. We have a waiting list. Well, we were in such chaos with this kid that even I agreed. I said, I'll do it. I'll give it up. And we did. We went into that program. I stopped drinking, went cold turkey. And I was able to do that for 3 years only because of the structure in that program. They took over our life. And you had to be heavily involved up there. You had to go there every day. And that kind of structure and discipline allowed me to make the transition from being an everyday drunk to no alcohol use. Eventually, my son picked up marijuana, was smoking marijuana. They found out, and we got tossed right out of the program. It was a zero-tolerance program, and we got thrown out. They gave me a little exit interview. They said, we'll refer you to counseling, but you're on your own, and we recommend you stay in counseling, which we tried to, but it didn't work out. But I was to go the next 7 years without picking up a drink and without any other kind of assistance. No AA, no structure, no guidance, nothing. I was now in White Knuckle City. And it was very difficult. I know a lot of you can relate to it. But what had happened, it got really scary fast. What happened was all those feelings I talked about when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, the fear, the pain, it was all back. It was all back, and it started coming back in huge waves, and now I had no medicine. I didn't understand what was going on. I could not comprehend what was going on. I really bought into the idea that I had kicked alcohol and I was okay. And I was anything but okay. I was scared to death. It turns out I came to realize that I was incapable of doing anything. I didn't know how to solve any problems, only because I didn't know how to talk to anyone. I didn't know how to say, okay, here's what the problem is, and what I need to do is I need to go speak to these people or that person on as to how to solve this problem, whether it was how to drive a nail or how to get car insurance or house insurance or some major problem. If it entailed talking to people, I was stumped. And this got worse and worse. It became a horror show. Eventually, I stopped calling any friends. My wife eventually left. She tried in vain to figure out what was going on and couldn't. She left. My oldest son left at that time, not the other guy. It was him, my younger daughter, and myself in the household, and we didn't speak hardly ever. And it got worse and worse and worse. One time I had a big problem with a faucet in the tub. It was leaking. I tried everything to fix it. I had to go to the store and get some kind of a part or ask about it. And I was terrified of this. I went to the store, looked and looked and looked, couldn't find it. And I knew at that point my only option was to go and ask the guy. Could not do it. I went back home and figured out how to live with the water pouring out of this faucet. I actually used to fill up big gallon cans of water and dump them outside. Rather than let them fill up the cesspool and ruin the cesspool, I mean, my brain was shot. And any kind of problem like this, I was useless. This really got bad. I eventually took up sailing, thinking it always interested me, and it did. But what really interested me was the solitary aspect of sailing. I bought a little boat, 14-footer, taught myself how to sail, of course, and started sailing, and it was great. I'm out there by myself, and the wind would stop, and I'd get crazy, and my alcoholism would kick in, and I'd rail at God and the world. So I got a boat with a motor, a cabin, electronics, some range, and now I was off to Connecticut and Block Island and everywhere by myself. And I couldn't be, the only place I could really feel safe was out in the middle of Long Island Sound. And very often I'd be sailing out in the middle of Long Island Sound, and I'd see a boat coming the other way, and I'd calculate, he's going to go right by me. I know it. I can see by his course, and the anxiety level would go through the roof. This guy's going to go by me and do that old Mariner wave thing. And I'd get crazy. And so he'd get about 300 yards away, and I would tack off to the right. Wait till he got past, tack back, and go back on my course. And then look back at the guy and say, I would have loved to say hello to that guy, but too scary. And that was a metaphor for my life. That's what it became. One day I was going home from that boat when there was no wind. I was driving home. I drove past a house out in Northport where I had a cousin then who lived there, and I knew she was in AA. And for some reason that is that could only be God inspired, I turned in her block and knocked on her door. And she was home, and she said, you know, she assumed I was in AA from years ago. I hadn't seen her, but I was not. And she said, what's going on? And I was like, I was shot. I said, I'm in trouble. She said, sit down. We talked for 3 hours. And I just all poured out what was going on, how the fear and the inability to do anything. And she said, you need help. What you're trying to do alone is absolutely impossible. You need help. And I said, what is help? She said, help is AA. You're an alcoholic. You need AA. And that scared me at first. She said, just trust me and do it. Go to this meeting tonight. I went to a meeting that night out in Long Island. I sat there scared to death. The guy got up there and talked all about fear and being different and not knowing what to do, how to solve problems, on and on. Told my story. I was one of those lucky guys who was in the right place at the right moment. I walked in that door probably at no better time in my life to hear that message that guy spoke that night. There was salvation for me. I had gone from living in this prison of my own design to with a complete blackness with no hope. To now, I walked out of that meeting that night with this little glimmer of hope. And I got a meeting list and went to a meeting the following day. And in the next 5 days, I went to meetings every day. And every day I heard that message of hope. And it was one of the most exciting times of my life. Because if you can relate to being without hope completely, you can relate to having when you first get that little glimmer of hope. I assumed that my life was just going to run its course out alone and more fearful in pain until I died somehow. That was going to be the way I lived my life out. And all of a sudden, they give me this glimmer of hope that get brighter and brighter. And it's since then, it's been sometimes two steps forward, one step back. But I always see that light. And I went from frozen in the middle of the forest in the dark, afraid to take a step in any direction for fear of going in further, to how have standing in that forest and seeing a light that I now had faith in and walking towards that light. And when I get into trouble emotionally, when I get afraid and it pops up again, all those years of being afraid and being uncomfortable and uncertain, I have that faith and I know that if I just keep walking towards that light that AA provided for me, I'm going to be okay. And I had some bad relationships in the course of those years. And about 4.5 years ago, I was at a meeting, and I heard a woman speak at this meeting who just fascinated me, this message that she had of AA. And I said, wow, that is the kind of woman that I could really relate to if I ever could encounter her. Well, because of some female conspirators that knew both of us from different areas, they found this out and figured out how for us to cross paths, and we did cross paths, and we got married a little over 3 years ago, and it's been one phenomenal stroke of luck. I'm afraid to even say that. It's not luck. It's AA. And she says all the time, it's about sick attracts sick, healthy attracts healthy, and that's all it is. And that's the only reason I came, that God put her in front of me. And it's been a phenomenal journey. My sponsor is here tonight, who has the kindness and gentleness of a gorilla at times. He tells me he thinks he's right all the time, and the worst part is, of course, he is. And it kills me, and I get angry with him sometimes, but he is always right. And he has been a tremendous influence in my life, and I'm forever grateful for him being in my life, as well as some other guys from Long Beach who have showed up for me tonight, the local stand-up comics who are back there who are going to work me over later. Very, very important people in my life. I love those guys. I have friends like that in my life all over today because of AA. The same way I have friends in this room tonight, even the people who have never seen me before, I know that we're friends, and you care about me and I care about you. It's the beauty of AA, where we can go on our journey together no matter where we go and constantly grow with each other's help. So I thank you very much from the bottom of my heart for this opportunity.